There's a whole lot of things I want to tell you about. Adventures, dangerous and queer. Some you could guess, and some I've only hinted at. So please lend me your ear.
Everyone has a relationship with gender. What's your story? Hello and welcome to Gender Stories with your host, Dr. Alex Yantafi.
Welcome to another episode of Gender Stories. It is my honor and my pleasure to introduce to you Redfern John Barrett, who is the author of two novels, including Proud Pink Sky, a speculative story set in the world's first LGBTQ plus state, which has been released by Bywater Books in March 2023. Redfern's essays, reviews, and short stories have appeared in publications including The Sun magazine, Guernica, Strange Horizons, Passages North, Pink News, Boof, FFO, Parsec, Orca, and Nature Futures. They're non-binary queer, have a PhD in literature, and currently live in Berlin, where actually this book is also set. So welcome, welcome, Redfern. It's so good to have you on Gender Story. Yes, I love that you have the physical copy. Please do show it, because now we do video as well as audio. So there's the book. It has a beautiful cover. You should definitely buy it. It's a fantastic book, and I can't wait to talk with you about it.
Me neither.
Oh, so let's start with, you know, I've read the book and I've got some questions about it, but let's start by introducing the book to our listeners and viewers and just maybe give them an overview without any spoilers, of course, for those who have not read it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Proud Pink Sky is set in the world's first gay state. It's an alternate Berlin. And the city is divided into different districts. So there's districts for different gay cultures, different lesbian cultures, and then bi people, queer people, trans people, and other people who don't conform in various ways live in slums on the outskirts. And it's really an exploration of LGBTQ identities and the conflicts and also solidarity that exist between our different communities. It's also an ambitopian novel, which is a concept that I've been exploring, merging the or breaking down the binary of utopia and dystopia in order to merge the extremes of both and create something wholly new, something that is dramatic and has, you know, these utopian dystopian elements, but which isn't dogmatically one way or the other, which is, I think is honestly the only way to explore LGBTQ cultures, you know, at large. So yeah, it's set in the world's first gay state. It follows two central characters. There's the teenage William, who with his lover escapes his homophobic home and flees to the city. And Sissy, who is a young mother of two, and she's been living in the city for 6 years, but she's never really explored it. And when the novel starts, she starts to get more curious about the city. And when her family's caught in a riot, she becomes in she finds it.
That's okay.
She's drawn to find out what's going on and to explore these cultures.
I love it. That I am so excited. For those of you who have not read this novel yet, you're in for a treat. It's really, really good. It's gripping. You know, when I picked it up, couldn't put it down. I just wanted to know everything that happened to the characters. So I highly recommend reading it. And I love that you mentioned the challenging that dystopian utopia binary, because actually that was one of my questions. Like, why did you feel it was important to challenge that binary construct in speculative fiction of utopia versus dystopia? Like, what made it feel like, why not go into one of the traditional directions, let's call them, of utopia and dystopia and go for this ambitopia, I think you called it, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, I have to be clear, I really love both utopia and dystopia. I'm not like anti those genres. And, you know, I've written dystopian short stories before. I've written works of dystopia. But I think that each of them have like their own limitations, you know. And I think they're sometimes not obvious for utopia. You know, I think we don't get a lot of works of utopian fiction because It can be quite a rigid thing, you know, to, you know, no one's really going to agree on what a perfect world actually is. And mm-hmm. also, that's a society that can never change, you know, that is permanently fixed, you know. And also just, it can be difficult to write utopia, you know, like finding conflict and drama within that setting, you know. Mm-hmm. And dystopia, you know, is a lot of fun. And I really, really enjoy writing dystopia. But the issue with dystopia is I don't think that it's as socially useful as a genre. You know, I don't think that, you know, we think of dystopia as warnings. And I think that implicitly we think of dystopia as protecting us against the scenarios that they show, you know. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily think of it overtly in that way. But, you know, there's this idea that these warnings can help protect us from the future. And I don't think that's really the case. You know, I don't think that, I always say, you know, I don't think that 1984 really did much, you know, to combat the surveillance state. You know, it didn't stop it. I mean,
It doesn't seem to have stopped it at all. You know, yes.
As much as I love cyberpunk, and Proud Pink Sky is a work of cyberpunk, it's portraying these kind of hyper-capitalist futures hasn't really done much to stop the momentum of, you know, sort of, you know, these kind of like distorted economic realities happening. And I think that what actually happens when we write speculative fiction and when we write the future, I think that we bring it closer into being. I think we change people's expectations of the future. So if we're to write a future scenario in which the government is overbearing and authoritarian, and other people pick up on that and create works that are the same, when you grow up with that, it gives the idea that that is what the future is going to be. You know, and if we, it's the same whether, you know, whether the future is kind of a polluted wasteland, you know, we almost then start to think of the world in a couple of centuries time as just being that, you know. So whereas utopia can inspire, I think that dystopia, like, likewise manages our expectations, you know, and kind of drags them down into envisaging futures that are darker and bleaker. So what I think is what I really want to do with Ambitopia is use the useful things about dystopia, for example, you know, these kind of like analyses of society and what could go wrong, what is going wrong, and extrapolate on that. And take the good elements of utopia, the elements that can give us hope, the elements that show what is good about our species and how things can get better, and to interweave the two of them, you know, in order to create fiction that is both inspiring but also deals with our real problems. And I think that that's something especially important for marginalized people, because, you know, I think it's very, very difficult for marginalized people often to connect with utopia, because it doesn't recognize the struggles that we go through. It doesn't recognize the suffering that we often experience, you know, and I think that can make it difficult, at least for me, to relate to, you know. Mm-hmm. Dressed like this, you know, I often get trouble on the street, and I can't really properly connect with realities that don't recognize that kind of oppression. At the same time, you don't want to wallow in it, you know. So I think that mix of hope and critique is really, really central to Ambitopia and what I think Ambitopia can be useful for.
I love that. And I love that. I'm paraphrasing what you said, I think, but you said it much more beautifully about when we write the future, you know, we're also kind of bringing into being in some ways. And I kind of got chills when you said that. And I thought, yes, really made me think about how, in a way, our fear, our collective fear, as expressed itself in a lot of dystopia, and really seeing the rise of even dystopian narratives in dominant culture, you know, through Hollywood movies and TV series like The Last of Us and so on. I think it's really a manifestation of how overwhelmed and afraid a lot of us are about the future. And so in a way, it was really refreshing to read this kind of Ambitopian novel where things were messy. You know what I mean? Things are not easy. Things were messy. And I love that, because life is messy. And so let's talk about speculative fiction as a medium for a moment, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I really think that speculative fiction, I don't think it's an accident that there are so many queer folks in speculative fiction, right? I think it really gives us an opportunity to like expand, explore, imagine even heal some time, right? And so I know you said a little bit about your feelings about dystopia versus utopia, but what's your relationship to speculative fiction as a genre in general?
I think like a lot of queer people, I think that we kind of need speculative fiction, especially, you know, in moments that do seem particularly dark, you know, when homo, queer and transphobia are all on the rise. And I think that we need to, it helps us to think about future possibilities. And, you know, I think that and it's a relationship that can be difficult and complex. For example, you know, like one of my favorite novels, you know, as a teenager was The Handmaid's Tale. And but I couldn't bring myself to finish watching the show because, you know, the current environment, I can't deal with watching a show in which I would be dead and my friends would be dead. You know, a future that doesn't even include us. And of course that's not a critique of Atwood's work. It is important and it is something that's had a huge impact. But I think that we really, really need kind of a level of inspiration. We have to look to the future. I mean, I think as well, that's something that a lot of marginalized groups likewise need, is to actually look forward and say, what can we build? What do we want? You know, it's an important part of activism. And also, I think just getting through the day, you know, for queer people to think of worlds that could be, you know, better or at least different from the one in which we live. And it's not pure escapism. That's an important thing as well. You know, it's not like we just want to, at least I don't just want to vanish into another world and forget about this one, as fun as that can be. It's to find inspiration, I think. And I think that's why so many queer people are drawn to speculative fiction, because they're often futures in which we can have more agency and less harm, I think. And for me, that's something that, you know, whether it's, I read recently Kat Rambo's You Sexy Thing, and I just loved it. You know, it's just this world in which sexuality, gender identity and everything is so much more fluid. I felt the same with Becky Chambers' work recently. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that can itself be really healing.
Absolutely. Oh, I have so many thoughts going on right now. But let's talk about the timing of your novel, because just the other day, you know, I was on Twitter and somebody was like, and again, I don't remember the exact words, but, you know, they tweeted something like, I think I'm ready to talk about kind of a LGBTQ+ nation, right? And I thought of you immediately because I'm like, oh, I've just been reading about that quite recently. And so, yes, during this kind of what I would call the rise of fascism in many countries, including where I'm located now, the US, my home country of Italy, I think the UK also is seeing kind of a rise of, we can call it conservatism, fascism, but whatever we call it, there is a lot of anti-queer and anti-trans, especially sentiment. Yes. The timing of your novel, in a way, seems pretty attuned to the times. Did that have an influence, like the current sociopolitical, cultural environment, on your decision to write this novel, or did the inspiration come from somewhere else? But I'm just curious about the relationship to this time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, the timing is something that is really kind of coincidental. I don't want to say fortunate, because it's not a fortunate situation. But I actually started writing this novel 10 years ago. When I started writing it was a short story. And, you know, I sent it out to some places and I got this kind of consistent response that this is too big a setting for a short story, that it would do with being longer. So yeah, then over 10 years, I wrote it and rewrote it. And it's something that's been influenced as time's gone by recent events. But at its core, the novel was always critiquing what I like to call kind of the nesting dolls of hate, for a start. You know, this idea of taking out your own oppression onto people who have even potentially even less power than you do. You know, that was something that I saw ever since I was 18 years old. That's where, you know, when I first went to university and got involved with, you know, sort of LGBTQ activism, you know, immediately, you know, of course, encountered a lot of lovely people and a lot of very tolerant and supportive people, as always exist in queer communities. But at the same time, I encountered, you know, immediately that kind of transphobia, biphobia. Mm-hmm. And it really puzzled me because it was like, you know, why do this? You know, we've been like invalidated ourselves. We've come under, you know, pressure and attacks ourselves. Like, why would you continue this? And mm-hmm. I've seen it kind of over and over, you know, both in Britain, I've seen it here in Berlin. And I couldn't really not write about it because it's something that has always kind of fascinated me. Like, what is this need? Where does it come from? And I think a lot of different places, which is what I wanted to explore in Propping Sky. But yeah, so it is kind of helpful, I think, in the way that it's coming out now as things are kind of coming more to a head, because I think it is more important than ever that queer and trans-aligned fiction actually is out there. Because I think that at the moment there is this kind of battle of people's perceptions of LGBTQ people. And I really, really think that we need to, and we don't get a lot of chance to tell our stories, to be perfectly honest. Like, the media generally isn't very interested in talking to actually queer and trans people. Yes. it's always a bunch of straight cis people talking about us to each other, as it's always been. And yeah, I think Propping Sky is has come about at an opportune moment. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and you talked about inspiration, right, with speculative fiction. I'm curious about, was there an intention of what you wanted to inspire in the reader with Proud Pink Sky, you know, and has that vision changed over the 10 years of writing the novel?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, this kind of ties back to Ambitopia again, because I think part of the reason that I don't feel very comfortable writing Utopia is I don't want to hand the reader my idea of a perfect world and be this is how things should be. And this is kind of the same with the message. You know, there are things that I wanted to explore myself. And I think that's really where my inspiration for writing generally comes from, is I get really curious about certain scenarios, certain aspects of humanity, and then I want to explore it for myself and then hope that other people do as well. So there's not like one particular message beyond, you know, kind of, I'm a very firm believer in solidarity. You know, I think it's really, really important, especially because the forces that are faced by minorities are very, very large, very well funded, and very well organized. And without solidarity, I really, really fear for the future. So that is a message that I wanted to get across. But the actual details of those things are something that I wanted to, for the reader to kind of interpret themselves. And so there's a lot of characters in Propping Skies, as you know, with a lot of different viewpoints. And I kind of didn't want any one of them necessarily to dominate, but to have this kind of collection of experiences in the novel and what it really means to be gay, lesbian, bi, trans, or queer.
Yeah, and one of the things that it's really interesting, even in the opening of the novel where you have just this little guide to this alternative Berlin, right, is that, oh, you're the gay district, you're the lesbian district, oh, bisexuality was made legal in 1969 or something like that, I think, in the novel. I don't know if I remember the year exactly. But I was curious about the role of identities that challenge binaries, whether it's kind of cisgenderism, so the gender binary, or the binary of gay versus lesbian, and what happens when that also becomes a challenging of power in this alternative kind of world. And so I hope I'm making sense. Does that make sense? Do
you think? Absolutely, yeah. And I think the challenging binaries is always to challenge power and power structures, mm-hmm. because yes. Power relies on binaries. It relies on in-groups and out-groups. And especially since the 19th century, we've really, really, our society has kind of gone all out on categorizing people and placing them in boxes. And that's something that has become core to people's conceptions of identity, is that they have this very, very fixed idea of themselves. It is distinct from another group. And that's true whether, you know, you're a straight person looking at gay people, or whether you're gay looking at trans people or lesbian people. It's there's always this compulsion to limit yourself. And I do understand that. You know, it's when I was 18, I came out as gay. And that was something that at first I really, really felt like kind of comforted by this kind of like the walls of this box, essentially. But then I feel like it's to kind of fundamentally ignore yourself, to just wall yourself in like that and to box yourself in. Because we're not static beings, we're always changing. And I think that it is really, really important. You know, if I'd seen myself now at 18 years old, I think I would have been terrified. You know, I think that would have really felt like, oh, what is this person? because I think I did, you know, I really bought into this idea of not outright masculinity, but, you know, kind of gender identity being very fixed and solid. And I'm kind of glad that I always stayed open to that. And I think that it is something that is hugely beneficial to question, you know, those binaries that we find ourselves in, both on like a kind of wider social level, but also on a personal one, because you really never know what you can find out about yourself.
Absolutely. I love what you said about that challenging binaries in some ways is to challenge power, because there is kind of almost a dizziness to the possibility and the expansiveness, right, of no boxes. And so I also really heard when you said there was comfort in those walls. I'm like, yes, from a trauma perspective, there is a sense of containment and belonging, right? This is where absolutely. I belong. Like, I remember when I first came out and, you know, I was saying I was bi, and there's a lot of biphobia on the lesbian scene, which is where I was at the time because of how I presented, and I didn't come out as trans yet. And so very quickly I was like, well, the only like cis men I'm attracted to are gay. So I guess I can be a lesbian, you know, because I wanted a sense of belonging, right? There is safety in the sense of like belonging to like a pack and being contained within a box. But then there's also limitations, right? Like you said, you never know what you can find out when you kind of go out of that box. And so that is such a feel that's both a micro and a macro struggle, right? It's an internal struggle. And I think it's also a political struggle, right? At the moment, there is a lot of talk, for example, of how a lot of disabled people feel really failed by even progressive and kind of leftist movements, right, during this pandemic, and now that we're all pretending that this pandemic is over. And so this idea of cross-movement solidarity, which is also in your book, is very challenging. So how did you, you know, this is also a story about organizing, I feel, in some ways, Proud Pink Sky, right? So how did you manage those challenges of portraying those tensions between, you know, in groups, out groups, people who fall into those cracks, right? Like bi and some bi and non-binary folks do. How did you navigate those? Because those are not easy conversations to write or tensions to write, I don't think.
Not at all. No. it was something very challenging. You know, I really, really didn't with this book at all want to privilege or prioritize any group over any other. You know, I think that there are absolutely wonderful and important aspects to all LGBTQ communities. I really didn't want to also, contribute to that division by writing a book that's like gay versus trans or something like that. That would be kind of opposite to the point. At the same time, you've got to kind of show these conflicts, show where these kind of prejudices come from and how those might be different in different communities. And so, yeah, it's this horribly difficult balance. I'm still not sure if I really got it right. I think probably every reader is going to feel different about that. But yeah, it's really something. And that's partly why it took so long to write as well, you know, trying to really, really bring all of this out. And also, you know, it's really important to me that straight and cis people can read this book and understand what's going on and identify with it themselves as well. You know, I didn't only want to write a book that was for the LGBTQ community. And so that's another challenge as well, you know, writing this in a way that actually is also in many ways like an introduction to LGBTQ cultures for those who aren't very familiar with it, whilst also not alienating people who are very familiar with it. You know, so It was just hard and it took a long time, to be perfectly honest.
That's fair. No wonder it took you 10 years to write this book. Yeah, really. I was up with you. I was like, that's a lot to like address there. And also I want to talk about the setting, because in a way I feel that setting in Berlin is connected to all of those conversations, right? And so I was curious about, you know, why Berlin, your relationship to Berlin. As somebody who I assumed from your accent has moved there from the UK, I don't want to make assumptions because we haven't talked about that, but that's my assumption I'm making explicit. So, and in a way, you know, my understanding of Berlin, even though I haven't visited in a long time, is that it is a city where there are a lot of differences and contradictions cohabiting, even in kind of queer world. And so, yeah, tell me more about what Berlin and your relationship to Berlin, if you want to, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. So I moved to Berlin in 2010. I'd lived in Wales for 8 years previously to that, where I'd done my studies. For a few years, I planned on moving to Berlin with my then partner. And it was something I had to finish my PhD and also save up enough money because we didn't have a lot of that.
Yeah.
So Berlin wound up kind of being this dream that I kind of had for a few years before it could actually happen. And I think like all of these kind of longer term dreams, when it actually meets reality, it can be quite a jarring experience, you know. Not that I knew exactly what to expect, but I kind of had this idea of Berlin as this, you know, almost queer utopia. You know? Especially, you know, you read Berlin's got 500,000 people who identify as gay and lesbian, presumably not even including, you know, bi, queer, trans people. And of course, I've had a lot of great experiences here, and I've met a lot of extremely wonderful people here. At the same time, nowhere is free from the same problems that I saw back in Wales, you know, and there's, in some ways, Berlin, even in an even more extreme way, has certain amounts of segregation in the city. Mm-hmm. Segregation is putting it too harshly, and I don't mean to appropriate that word, but Berlin has these kind of like divisions and separations.
Divisions, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, like, for example, I think it's like much less common for queer men and queer women, for example, to spend time together in Berlin than it was back in Wales, you know, probably because the community is smaller. And maybe because the community is so much bigger here, people can kind of divide off, you know, into their own groupings that don't have a huge amount of contact necessarily with each other. I think that partly was kind of an inspiration for Proud Pink Sky, you know, this kind of... when we actually have enough of us, it almost becomes less unified, you know, than more. And I've kind of gone up and down a lot with the city, you know, over the years. I've been here for 13 years now. So it's that's a lot of time to have a lot of different feelings about it. I think that's also kind of what inspired me to start writing Ambitopia as well, because that's how I feel about this city. You know, Berlin is a city of extremes. And that's extreme good and extreme bad, and this kind of uncanny mix of the two, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I really related when you talked about, you know, when there's more of us, it's easier to kind of separate it and kind of hive off. I don't know if that's the right term, but, you know, yeah. I remember, like, even, you know, and of course, there's more openly out and trans queer people in Italy now, but in the 80s, not a lot of people were out as queer and trans, right? And so there is kind of a coming together across identities, you know. Even I used to be on this like Italian lesbian email list, and it wasn't a big deal when I came out as bi. People were in all sorts of living situations because, you know, queer stick together no matter what, right? But when you have more people, then it's easier to kind of almost replicate those structures of power that we're used to, right? Oh, let me stay safe in kind of my area. But then what happens when you don't easily belong to one district, literally, actually, in your book, or the other, right? Then you end up at the margins again, right? Because you don't quite belong neatly into a box. And so, yeah, I'm just kind of just reflecting on that idea of like, we can have those utopian dreams, like you said, but those utopian dreams can quickly become dystopian if you don't fit neatly into the very tight box, which cannot change. And I think we're seeing a lot of that with even, cis queer people being increasingly recruiting into this anti-trans movement, right? Almost like this is a threat to, your identity. Who's really gay, in air quotes, who's really lesbian, trans people are taking away from our communities. Just that sense of fear. And I don't know if you want to kind of comment on that or if that's also part of what you kind of saw in the world and kind of wove into the book
It is something that, I encountered from the moment that I started, when I joined what was then the LGBT society at my university. And, there were those of us who fought very hard to have the T added at the time. It was often quite extreme. At Swansea University in the early 2000s, there was a huge amount of anti-trans sentiment and backlash. And I was one of the only male-bodied people who was campaigning against this anti-trans sentiment. And I was very afraid at the time. And I think that made... I remember giving a speech, for example... in front of the student body, and the president of the union at the time, who I felt was quite a transphobic person, packed the meeting with athletics union, sports guys. And there were about 200 of them, and I had to give the speech. And it was, I was sort of shaking and trying to give the speech. Those kind of experiences really kind of have stuck. And I think that wound up inspiring the novel in that sense. And I think that the response from a lot of gay and lesbian people at the university at the time was fear, was real fear. And it was, we've got to protect ourselves by distancing ourselves from people who seem less normal than us, It's like a kind of sucking up to the bully kind of mentality, I think. In some ways, that fear is understandable. I felt that fear too. But it's really, really not the right approach. And, I think that people who spend any time thinking about this, you realize it doesn't stop at one group. You're always next on the chopping block. And I think that this kind of has always been there. But the difference recently is that there are very, very, very well-funded campaigns against trans people in particular, because elements of the right are always looking for wedge issues, always looking for scapegoats, and trans people fit the bill perfectly because a lot of people are quite ignorant about trans views, trans people's experiences. And so I don't think it's necessarily, in some ways it's something that is quite old, but at the same time it's something that is been given a kind of new force, a new like empowerment to it. And so we have to like kind of work hard never to establish the solidarity. And I think that solidarity does exist with most gay, lesbian and bi people towards trans people. I like to think about the fact that one of the most pro-trans groups that there is are lesbian women. That there's an overwhelming amount of support when surveyed among lesbian women towards trans people. Not to say that there's not been transphobia in lesbian communities, of course. But the media kind of often distorts this, and it takes these like few transphobic gay and lesbian people and platforms the hell out of them. So that even if 95% of people who are gay or lesbian either have no strong feelings towards trans people or stand in solidarity with them, it gives an impression that there's ultimately like this huge groundswell of hate. Which I think is a real problem, obviously.
Absolutely. And, when you were talking about, in a way, those kind of techniques to inspire fear, right? Like taking this 5% and platforming, or like the president of the student union, like packing you know, the room with like jocks, basically, like sports people. It's an intimidation technique, right?
Yeah.
And it made me think about the opening of your book where the, you know, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but there is a young person who, after being bullied and, you know, experiencing physical violence from their peers, then is subject to kind of the headmaster's intimidation and threat, really, for the story of homophobic violence that kind of he uses to intimidate this young person. And then there is an exchange with this young person, their lover, about, you know, their lover going, can't you be more of a lad, right? Because even if it's about sexuality, it's also about gender, right? It's about those people who just cannot hide it, right? And so because that there is that dialogue, right, which makes sense, like in terms of survival, right? Some people survive by hiding and pretending and sometimes even participating in the homophobic violence against peers because it's so scary to be on the other side. But some of us have never been those people who can hide it, right? And then what happens, you know? And I love the opening of the novel because I really, I don't know, I just felt a lot of people, including myself, could relate to what happens to those of us who don't fit into this box that gets narrower and narrower and narrower in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's experience I had as well. You know, it's growing up, I was never, and I think that, you know, the more that I kind of dive into my own identity and think about myself, you know, the kind of more a lot of my experiences fall into place and kind of make sense. And, you know, as a kid, I really didn't fit in terms of gender, you know, binary gender identity at all. You know, I played with toy cars and dolls, you know, and I know that it feels kind of silly to say because it's never like one thing that's like based on gender identity. You can't like pinpoint these are the toys I played with. This demonstrates, you know, but it's like a collection of all these different experiences together that, you know, start to make sense. I always had a lot of friends who were boys and friends who were girls and didn't really ever fit in with either. And, you know, as a kid, of course, that just hurts. You don't think about, like, what you might be. You only see what you're not. And, yeah, that was something that I really, really was important to put into the novel. You know, this kind of real inability to fit in. And it's something so cruel, especially when you're younger. You know, and you're told by all the adults around you, you know, you just need to do this. Just act, and essentially, it's always some variant of just act more normal. But, like, our natures aren't something that we can consciously just change. And the best that we can do is essentially put a wall around our true selves and act out a performance of who we're supposed to be. And I think that the personal and the social impact of that is enormous. I genuinely believe that we would have a much, much better world if people didn't feel pressured into doing that. Because I really think that that comes out in thousands and thousands of different ways.
Oh, absolutely. Like even just thinking, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the conversations I was having with cis women just before and after top surgery, for example, and how many cis women felt that gave them permission to talk to me about how they hated their chest or they would also get rid of it if it was socially or culturally acceptable. And I was like, well, you can actually. It's like there's no rule. There's like no rule that you have to like keep your body as is, right? Since time immemorial, humans have looked at body modification as a way to kind of express and align, right? But there are those scripts, right? There are the scripts that people feel they have to fall into. You know, well, this is what I'm supposed to do if I'm assigned male at birth, and this is what I'm supposed to do if I'm assigned female at birth, and this is what being a cis woman means, and this is what being a cis man, and then we replicate those in our community. This is what being trans means. This is what being non-binary means. Like, who's non-binary enough? Who's trans enough? You know, who gives you the card? And I was like, there are no cards, people. There's literally, I mean, there are cards now because you can put an X, I guess, on your driver's license here, although I'm still a little bit nervous about that level of identification by the state. But, like the, just this feeling that people have to fall into the script And one of the things I love in the book, I know we're talking about a lot of a heavy topic, but there was something that was, it's funny and not funny at the same time, right? In the opening, when there's the guide, there's this little like script flip around heterosexuality, like heterosexuals are fine in the gay republic, as long as you like, you know, and again, I'm paraphrasing, but like, don't put in our faces, right? Keep your public display of affections to yourself, which is what a lot of experience, right? How many of us have heard from family members or straight colleagues, like, I'm fine with queer people, but you have to kiss on the street? Do the children have to see that? Well, like children don't exist also, in, you know, in terms of queerness and transness, right? So I love that flip in the script, but there's also a shadow to flipping the script, right? In that then, like, sometimes that's also used against bi folks and manifesting biphobia. And so, yeah, I was just curious about that kind of flip script flip, whichever way around that you explored in Proud Pink Sky.
It would have been, I think, very easy to just write a novel in which kind of like homophobia is replaced with heterophobia. And,
yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a wacky world that's upside down where straight people are oppressed. And there is this element in the novel of mm-hmm. You know, you kind of have what it means in the state to be a real citizen of this Berlin. Mm-hmm. And that is to be in a same-sex marriage. That's the ideal in this world. So, of course, this exists, but it's something that, yeah, absolutely. Applies to bi people in particular and pansexual people. It's and there are scenes in the novel that demonstrate that, you know. Then it's also something that, you know, again, I think if you've hung out in gay spaces, for example, you do see that, you know, it's this whole, and thankfully I hope it's getting better, but, you know, I'm so tired of hearing people like ill vaginas kind of thing, as though men can't have vaginas, and like, of course they can. And also as though, like, I'm sorry, but you don't have to be disgusted by something or someone because you don't find them sexually attractive. It's like the most immature response. It's like, I don't know, I don't find like plants sexually attractive, but I'm not disgusted by them. And I really, really kind of wanted to explore that element, because I also think that an unhealthy thing that can often happen when you do receive a lot of abuse socially is to retreat into this identity and to shun, again, this is binary thinking, to shun kind of what is seen as the opposite of this identity. So you see that with this kind of disgust shown, say, for example, among gay men towards women or towards vaginas or towards heterosexuality. And I think that has knock-on effects that allow you to punch down. So that's particularly with anti-bi sentiment and anti-trans sentiment. Mm-hmm. And I think that also this, I've seen this happen as well. You know, I've been in touch with a lot of people involved with women's groups and in South Wales. There was a particular community that I knew several people from that, I don't like using this term a lot because it's abused, but there's a certain amount of misandry to this community. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there's a real, like, male pets aren't allowed on the land. Women who don't have their gender tested of their baby have to leave after like 3 or 4 months of pregnancy. It's almost like this kind of mythical idea of like the penis being this kind of source of evil and oppression. And I think that when you get into this kind of level of essentialism and binary, it really, really has these knock-on effects against even more vulnerable people. And I think a lot of the transphobia that is coming from, particularly in Britain, is coming from kind of this kind of aversion that comes from your own victimization, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we all get it. I think there can be this temptation to be like, you know, I'm going to be anti-straight because I've had so much shit from straight people. Mm-hmm. But there's all sorts of unintended consequences about that. And honestly, it's never going to hurt the people who are in positions of who have more social power. It's only ever going to punch down, you know?
Oh my God, so much so. I have so many thoughts on that one, because it's like, it doesn't hurt just the people who are not in the category. It hurts everybody, you know? As you were talking, I had so many kind of memories, like little snippets of moments, you know, being at the queer bar and, you know, having my lesbian friends going, oh, ew, did you just lend your inhalers to that man? And I was like, yes, he was having an asthma attack and didn't have his inhaler on him. That's happened to me too. Of course, I gave him my inhaler, right? And there was always like, you know, not only, oh my God, somebody with a penis touched your inhaler, which I was like, what level of purity are you all immersed in? But also this piece, this terrible piece around, you know, HIV phobia. Like, well, what if they're like, what if they're HIV positive? I was like, yeah, what if they are? That is not how it transmits. I have a lot of close folks, right? And it's like, so it was so, and then on the other end, you know, hanging out with a lot of gay men, because I used to be in HIV research. I remember going for coffee, and for some reason, there was one of those you vaginas conversation. And I just had like an OBGYN appointment that morning, and I was just done. And I remember just like going, okay, if you then have one and you're not putting your penis in one, you cannot talk about it right now. And you know, the silence descended, right? And I think it's just those moments, and those moments were also painful because it's like, you don't fit neatly anywhere, right? It's like, I didn't get invited to some of the like boys' dinner, right? Even when I was trans masculine, because I wasn't quite masculine enough. There's always something suspect, right? And so I'm with you. It would be easy to retreat. I totally get, and I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm all about T4T and retreating in trans community, but that's not exempt from issues either, right?
So yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, sorry, I have to be clear, like, I'm not against marginalized people having safe spaces, and I think those are really important, you know, but it's like, I think that there's a kind of difference between coming together, people like yourself, and sharing your experiences and feeling safe for a while, and like, you know, sort of pushing away other people. Yeah,
exactly. And safe for whom, you know? In a way, it's like, if we are basing on this biological determinism, we're leaving out a lot of people. And yeah, so even, you know, in spaces that should be safe, in air quotes, they're not safe, because then there's all this kind of, honestly, kind of bigotry and hate, which I understand it's protective, right? It's so much easier to think there's a big bad. I was brought up a second wave feminist, right? So the penis was the enemy. You know, there were people who were like, political lesbianism was the purest thing that you could do, right? And also I've seen people like, very painfully, women who had done that and then in their 40s and 50s come to terms with their bisexuality because they fall in love with a cis male partner, you know, their community falling apart, their support system falling apart, the pain of now no longer belonging to queer community, you know, in some ways. And it's just heartbreaking. I mean, I get the feeling as humans, we want a big bad, right? There's nothing more satisfying than to read a book or watch a movie where, yes, there's the big bad, you know, the ultimate boss, you know, like in games, but there is no ultimate boss, right? It's like, and that's what I love about your book, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, again, you know, what I think is important with Ambitopia is, yeah, you're right, that there's not like a big bad. And, you know, sometimes, you know, there are characters in Proud Pink Sky who, and again, to avoid spoilers, I have viewpoints that I would think are much less sympathetic than others. Mm-hmm. But it's something I always try to go in with understanding where this comes from and why is this. And this particular character, Lovey, in the book, who... honestly, I poured a lot of some of my darker thoughts into, you know, but it's again, it's something that, I really, I believe in many ways that this person's position can be understood. It's, but it has these kind of very dark manifestations. And I think that, I was in Brighton recently and doing reading of the novel, and I met up with MJ, who I think you know, MJ Barker.
Yeah, my writing partner. Yes.
I always love meeting with MJ. And we were talking about, you know, this kind of desire to single out specific people or single out specific, you know, because it's like, it's visible, it's like vanquishable. But in reality, what we're dealing with are forces and traumas like manifesting through individual people, but it's not really about those people, you know, like, and that's something else that, you know, I kind of wanted to explore in the book was like, how does trauma wind up influencing kind of oppression? How does trauma generate oppression? You know, and Yeah, I'm probably going off a massive tangent.
No, that's a great tangent, because I think it has a lot to do with trauma, right? If I think about, you know, my own experience as a survivor, there was an appeal in some ways in second wave feminism in, like, you know, this is bad because males, you know, and cis males, the amount of time, are perpetrators and aggressors. But there was a part of me that could never fully buy into that, probably because of my own trans identity, right? Even though I was still finding my own voice to that. And also because I was never into those extremes. There was a part of me that always resisted this dichotomy. So it felt too narrow. It felt too limiting, right? And I also understand, like, I have a lot of compassion for, oh, I see where you're at. I see you're hurting. I see you're trying to keep yourself safe. But in keeping yourself safe, you're actually now inflicting pain and lateral violence and trauma potentially on other people, right? And that's kind of, in a way, how trauma perpetuates if we're not careful. You know, well, I've been a victim, and those people over there are the perpetrators. So there is nothing, right, that I could say or do that is bad enough. But actually there is, right? Because not, you know, it's kind of this confusing almost the micro with the macro, right? It's like not any one category can be seen as evil, because that takes away our humanity. It's dehumanizing.
Absolutely. And I think that there's a really, really good point that you made with that, like with, you know, kind of having this idea that the evil is elsewhere. Yes. And I was, in my teenage years, I was part of a homophobic Christian evangelical movement, which was had its own breed of trauma. And one thing that I noticed among that community was the evil was always somewhere else.
Yeah.
The evil was coming from Satan, from the bad people, from the people in society who are ungodly. And when you do that, and I think that this same mentality can exist if you're not careful, when you are part of a marginalized group and you're like, well, the evil is men, or the evil is straight people. And there are critiques of men and straight people that need to
absolutely
be made. But it's what happens, I think, when you do that is you erase the idea of your own capacity for evil.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like, it reminds me of this kind of this community that I used to be part of, because, like, they really, really would, you can do kind of awful things. You can treat people terribly, and you won't really ever question yourself, because you are on the side of good and you're not part of the evil. And I think that that can lead to some of, like, humanity's most destructive impulses. And I also think that that can be a problem, tying it back to sci-fi genres, that can be a problem with utopian thinking. You know, it creates this idea that the evil is something else, that it can be eradicated, that it's not something that we always have to question ourselves about. You know, it's, and I think we've seen, like, throughout history as well, this idea that, like, if we take, like, a very, very fixed idea of class, for example, you know, there can be this idea that if we just take everything away from the capitalist class, then, you know, the evil will be fixed and we'll have, like, a utopia. And, you know, I'm not saying this is a great defense of capitalism, but, like, the problem with that kind of mentality is that it then allows for atrocity, you know, and this is a much bigger scale than, say, like, you know, gay or lesbian communities. Mm-hmm. But we always have to be able to look for the evil within ourselves, you know, to actually watch out for, well, what is, you know, because we all get afraid, we all get scared, we all get angry, and we all have the capacity to do terrible things while in those frames of mind.
Absolutely. And I think that part of the healing from trauma for me is kind of claiming agency and power and coming to terms with the fact that actually any human, including ourselves, had the capacity to hurt other people, you know, both intentionally and unintentionally. And actually we do. And what the best we can hope for is not to do it intentionally. And the best we can hope for is that when we do it unintentionally, it's not too terrible and that there is the possibility for repair, right? And I love, like, how sci-fi has started to explore that, I think, in a lot of ways, right? That I think there are a lot of wonderful writers that explore that much more nuanced, right? From Octavia Butler to the much more kind of dominant culture, Doctor Who, right? There are so many moments, especially in the latest kind of season, where, and the one before, where there could be you know, the doctor could turn towards destruction of the enemy, but cannot, because that's not who she is, right? And so it's just like this very human struggle, right? Like this very human struggle of like, when is it okay to hurt somebody else? When is it okay to obliterate somebody else, right? When is it okay? Like all those big existential questions that get explored in speculative fiction, which are very much also in your book. And that, I think that's what I love about it, is that there are very existential themes in a way that you explore.
Yeah, they can't be avoided.
Yes, you really can't avoid existential themes as a writer. That's fair. That is very fair. I mean, some people sometimes do, but really it's pretty hard to avoid existential themes.
Yeah, really. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that a lot of what we've been talking about, you know, these, they're not things that are limited to any one group. And again, you know, with Proud Pink Sky, yeah, it's a novel about the world's first gay and lesbian state. But more than that, it's a novel about trauma. It's a novel about, you know, oppression. It's a novel about group identity. And, you know, those are things that I think that all of us in different ways can relate to. You know, it's not something that is limited to LGBTQ groups by all means. I think that these are very, very human things.
Absolutely. So I feel like I could have this conversation forever, as I do with pretty much all of my guests, but I want to be respectful of your time. The last thing I want to talk about is actually Pride and how it's handled in Proud Pink Sky, because we are coming into Pride Month. And so it seems very seasonally appropriate to kind of talk a little about what's Pride Month like in the gay republic, you know, in an LGBTQ plus state. What meaning does Pride have in this kind of alternative kind of queer history timeline, let's call it?
Well, I mean, that's the thing, because it's, you know, the world's first gay and lesbian state, you know, Pride and the celebration of Pride almost become, is also like kind of a national holiday. Yes. You know, it's kind of like the 4th of July of this gay state. And so, you know, it's something that within the novel is, you know, a huge amount of festivities, decorations, you know, it's kind of the biggest holiday of the year in the Berlin of the novel. Yeah, that's, you know, it's, I've always had a kind of very, very mixed relationship with Pride myself. So I was part of a group that helped establish Swansea's first, in city in South Wales, first gay Pride, well, LGBTQ Pride. It was, we did consciously include all groups. It didn't wind up getting remembered as that, because there wound up being a commercial Pride came along a couple of years later that advertised itself as the first. But we had like our own, like much less well-funded Pride. I went to Pride in Cardiff and then moving to Berlin. And Berlin has multiple Prides. Yes. And there's the big mainstream commercial Pride, which, you know, I honestly have never actually gone on, because I've just never really connected with the kind of mainstream Pride events. I think they're important. I think that people, you know, should really go and enjoy themselves. I'm not against these kind of mainstream Prides, but I just never really felt the kind of energy of them somehow. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of queer Pride that used to take place in the city, but then, you know, kind of the usual left-wing infighting destroyed it. But that was a beautiful event that used to take place in my neighborhood. And it would be, you know, thousands of queer people and just this beautiful atmosphere, but also included everyone, you know, and it wasn't very commercial. That's kind of been replaced in Berlin with the Dyke March, which is this very, very queer inclusive sort of lesbian queer march, which I went on last year. Includes people of all genders. It was a really, really lovely event. I don't know. There can be so many things that are Pride, is my point.
Absolutely.
So many different ways of doing Pride. You know, you can have the kind of like corporate sponsored, very flashy, very big Pride. You can have the kind of DIY, you know, sort of put on your best dressing up clothes and like all just come out together and just have a messy time and everything in between. And in the novel, you know, it's even though it's kind of the state function, I still kind of wanted to serve this idea that like Pride isn't one thing, that there's like all of these like thousands and thousands of different prides like happening around this time, just like in you know, our world.
I love that, because in a way that corporate pride, and I could be wrong, but it feels it's almost replaced by this kind of nationalist pride, right, in the book. Because like you said, it is like the 4th of July kind of celebration for the gay and lesbian republic. And so, yeah, I love what you talked about, that it is so many things. And in a way, it's an experience of connection and celebration. But what happens when we cannot connect and celebrate for whatever reason, right? And so how do we then find new ways to connect and celebrate? That process, in a way, it's never ending, right? Because also things transform. And again, I could keep talking about this, but I'm going to be respectful of your time and the listener's time. And so I'm going to ask you the last question that I always ask, which is there anything that I have not asked you about that you are really hoping to talk about or to make sure you communicate it to the listeners and viewers of Gender Stories?
I mean, we've covered a lot of things. I generally, I've just enjoyed this conversation so much that I can't think of it. I'm sorry, probably like 5 minutes after we sign off, I'll think of something. I really can't think of anything. I think this has been a really, really great and wide-ranging discussion. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was really fun. And I don't mean to put you on the spot. I always just want to make sure that if there is anything, you know, you get to communicate it to folks. And if people want to find out more about you and your work and want to get your book, because now they're all excited to read about this book, where could they find out more about you or follow you on social media or get the book from?
So there's my website, which is kind of a central thing. And it has a very short URL. It's redjohn.com. So redjohn.com. I'm on Mastodon at Redfern. I'm in the main instance, the Mastodon social. And my publisher is it's Amble Press, which is an imprint of Bywater Books. So you can go find them on their website. And there was one thing I mentioned. A friend of mine made this incredible trailer for the novel that, like, I absolutely love and couldn't be happier with. And if you just go into YouTube and just search Proud Pink Sky, the trailer will come up. And, I love that trailer. I'm really, really happy with it. It's so cinematic and exciting. And, And if all else fails, like just Googling Proud Pink Sky will come up.
Now I have to go find that trailer and I will connect it in the description of the episode. Because that sounds great. Oh, yeah. Video trailers for books are awesome. You know, I've been thinking about making one and then it feels too complicated. But I'm excited now to watch the video trailer. Well, thank you so much. This has been such a wonderful conversation. And listeners and now viewers of Gender Stories, if you're watching us on YouTube, please get hold of Proud Pink Sky, especially if you love speculative fiction. But even if you have never read speculative fiction, give it a go, because there is just so much goodness, as you heard, so many themes. Exactly. Show that beautiful cover again. Absolutely. I would show it if I could, but I only had the PDF. So it is a beautiful cover. You know, that's nice, like those purples that us queers love. And so, yeah, read Proud Pink Sky and watch out for Maud Redfern's work. And thank you so much for spending time with us today. This was great. Until next time.